Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web, and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And joining us tonight, in place of Tosin Anafuaken, who is out this week, we have Greg Davies. Greg of the TARDIS Blend and Blendover podcasts, and a frequent guest on the show here. How are you doing, Greg?
I am absolutely ecstatic to be here on The Drill Down again. I must apologize first off, because the last time I was invited, I ended up not being able to come here because we had a major power outage at my work, and one of our critical network components went down, and it never went up until about 5 o'clock the next morning, which was Thanksgiving morning. So, yeah, lots of fun. But I'm back. I'm here, and I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
That's painful. I remember, because I was, I would have been here except for the fact that I was at the Doctor Who Festival.
Yes.
Or convention when that happened to you.
Yeah, over in the UK?
Yeah, I went to check it out. I sent Tom and Andy some tidbits from where I'm at.
Yeah, some great pictures.
I got to meet Mr. Smith, mm-hmm. so to speak.
Oh.
And a couple other things. So it was a blast. Yeah, we've got a chat on your show, and I'll give you any updates that I picked up.
Yeah, absolutely, and of course we'll be having a TARDIS Blend coming up later this month, because we've got the Christmas special of Doctor Who coming up on Christmas Day.
I know, I can't wait. I just can't wait.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
On this week's Drill Down. Google previously bought 7 robotics companies, and this week it buys the big dog, literally. Sprint guns for T-Mobile. Instagram wants a piece of Snapchat's action. Twitter changes blocking and then changes their mind about changing blocking. And are the NSA's actions unconstitutional? As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. So before we get into the headlines tonight, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And I want to talk about this week. I went to go see The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, as they pronounce it in the movie. And I believe that's the correct Tolkien pronunciation. But I saw it in high frame rate 3D, which is the way I saw the previous Hobbit movie. And I remember we talked about when this it was a year ago. It was a year ago from now that we talked about this, the first Hobbit movie. And I remember complaining. I had some minor complaints about the HFR presentation, in that it felt a little bit like there were moments when there weren't any humans on the screen, where it was all CG characters like the orcs. And it felt like I was watching a video game cinematic. It had sort of like that creepy...
Did you feel that way this time again, or did you only feel that way the first time last year?
This time was different, and I think that they have actually improved the execution of the high frame rate 3D, because this time it definitely felt there was less of that sort of that perception of fast motion also that I had felt watching the HFR in the first movie. It felt less like a video TV production and more like just realistic motion. I didn't feel taken out of the film by the high frame rate, which is what you want. You want it to be a seamless presentation, so you're not thinking about the HFR.
Right. I mean, I've seen the film too. It's a better film. It's composed better, mm-hmm, I think, mm-hmm, because. Mm-hmm. A lot of the CGI was focused on rendering the dragon, Smaug, as well as some of the effects. I mean, some of the times with the effects were a little strange, like the whole gold thing was a little weird. I'm going to ride on a river of gold.
Right. That's the only sort of effect that really felt sort of like, thin.
But other than that, I mean, I think the rendering of Smaug was pretty impressive, especially the rendering of all the treasure, because that is difficult to do.
Yeah.
A million little pieces of little, like, shiny things all over the place.
Oh, sure.
Moving. That's not easy. So I was pleased. I mean, obviously, as a guy who studied English and who's very familiar with Tolkien's works from the Silmarillion, you know, all the way to what his son put out, there's a big difference between this book and, you know, what you get out of the film. But you know what? I think regardless of that difference, the film was very entertaining. And if you're at all a fan of this genre, high fantasy kind of thing, it's worth seeing.
Dwayne, let me ask you this. Andy, you know, on the Blendover podcast, we spoke a little about The Hobbit and Peter Jackson and everything. And one of the things that we had mentioned at one stage was, wouldn't it be interesting if he, in the future, in the far future, if he returned yet again to Middle-earth and tried to take on board the Silmarillion?
The Silmarillion isn't really... So, like, the difference between the Silmarillion and the other works is that while the other works tend to be novels, Silmarillion is more of a, let's call it a biblical situation. And what's different about it is that the Silmarillion, unlike The Hobbit and unlike The Lord of the Rings, it does not show you what happens. It tells you what happens.
Right.
Right? And a good story is shown to people. It's not told to people.
Right. You know? So it's more of an apocrypha kind of deal, isn't it?
Right, it's got a lot of Leviticus, a lot of like Genesis going on, like, and this person begat that person, and this thing begat that, and it's not really like if he took on the Silmarillion, it would actually provide him with a great deal of license to create characters and bring, you know, personality to those characters, because you don't get personality. You got that, you know, this thing was evil, and this thing became evil. But you don't get like, hey, man, I became evil because I fell in love with this girl and you stole it from me. You know, like.
Dwayne, I want you to know that the way you just described the Silmarillion was exactly the way I described it on Blendover.
Yes, indeed.
I mean, that's really.
But
that's
you know really what I'm afraid of? You know, my big fear is that I feel like now, like, Jackson is going to be mining sort of the Hobbit apocrypha for the rest of his career, and it's going to get to the point where, like, this happened fairly early on in the James Bond series, where they would take titles of short stories that Ian Fleming had written that had nothing to do or very little to do with James Bond at all, and those would be.
There's a difference here. I think there's a lot more respect for the work here than with James with Ian Fleming's work. I mean, frankly, a short story makes a better film than a novel. Mm-hmm. At least in my
that's not necessarily true. I mean, look at what they're doing with the Walter Mitty movie coming out, which looks completely different from the original short story.
Right. What I'm saying though is that you look at like a Philip K. Dick short story or any of those, and with a short story, there usually is more like. I mean, I'll start over. An adaptation is not necessarily meant to be a straight-up reproduction of the book. It's supposed to be different. It's an adaptation. There's a different media here. You have to, like, if they had tried to cram the entire Hobbit into one movie, that would have been terrible because they wouldn't have covered stuff. Stretching it out to three movies seems a bit long, and they've had to add stuff, like the whole gold thing and everything. But I think The Hobbit is the kind of piece that's long enough to probably bridge two movies, but where do you do the break? Where do you break that? When you have a short story, you think about how long it takes for you to read a good short story. It takes about an hour. Expressing that visually and getting all those elements in, you could definitely get that to 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So I feel like a short story between, you know, 6 and 40 pages is really ripe and really it makes for a really rich film. But that's usually like a minor work film, like a Gattaca kind of thing. When you look at these epics, which is what Peter Jackson wants to do. This is his legacy now, these six films. This is like an epic, and the epic needs epic stuff, and he wants to add that epic stuff, which is why Smog is fantastic, because he's so great and terrible and somewhat charismatic. And it is a little strange to see Sherlock Holmes looking at Watson and hanging out with him on screen.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting, though, and I think what where Andy's coming from is that the future for Peter Jackson is feasibly one, two possible scenarios. Either he can't get anything else done and therefore he keeps mining the Middle Earth world for new material, or he's forever going to be running away from being known as the guy that successfully put the world of Middle Earth on screen.
I propose a third option.
Mm-hmm.
I propose that he manages to take his Middle Earth work and the lack of success from his Lovely Bones and King Kong. King Kong is a moderate success, but Lovely Bones, I think we'd all agree, was a failure. And I think he can look at the world now and say, I'm tired of adapting other people's work. I'm tired of taking other people's work and showing it off. I can do more stuff than that. And he can go back to his roots of creating new products that are new projects that are just out of his mind, that are just movies, native movies. And he's now got the budget and the wherewithal to get some of that stuff done in really fantastic ways. A fourth option would be for him to say, look, I've made the money. They wanted me to be a producer on The Hobbit. I wanted to be a producer on The Hobbit, but they forced me to be a director. That's fine. I did it. I'm happy to do it. But now I've got a chunk of money, and I have a network of directors around. You know, I managed to keep my director friends who would have done this movie. Now I've got a network of directors. I've got the money. How about I produce? Mm-hmm. I make a production company, and I let my directors, who I trust, put together the types of films that I'm happy to get behind, and perhaps the types of films that Hollywood isn't happy to get behind, because that was one of the big problems he's constantly run into. Hollywood being too conservative to allow him to do things like throw The Hobbit at Guillermo del Toro, or to chase down a couple other projects. Like, no, get back to what you do best, Peter. Go back to Tolkien. Go do that stuff. Mm. If he's tired of it, he's got options now. And I think especially when it comes to the private projects, you know, like doing a film, a native film, just right out of his, you know, out of his creativity, which he's already proven. That's how he got these chances.
Sure.
If he can do that with Fran by his side, because she's a fantastic writer, I think he can really get some things done. I don't think his legacy is over. And while this may be his magnum opus in terms of popular appeal, mm-hmm. I think he has a chance in the next 20 years to push the envelope significantly, although I hope he loses a little bit of weight, because it's not healthy to be that big.
Right.
Well, there's also he's also looking seriously at television now, too.
I mean, television is also great. I mean, we've all seen that the small screen has in many ways become more powerful than the big screen. If the big screen is silver, I would say the small screen has become gold, especially when it comes to adaptation. Because while I said that a small novella becomes a great film, a novel becomes a great TV series. If you can take a novel and turn that into 10, 12, 14 episodes of something, a nice finite amount that doesn't stretch it out the way the three big networks want you to do it, then you can really get into the depth of what a novel is, and an audience will follow you week by week, or they'll binge watch it. But regardless, if you can do that in those 45-minute increments, you can really get people behind a novel. We've seen that power with Game of Thrones. And we've seen the power of the miniseries alone with things like Band of Brothers and letters from, you know, and the Japanese version of that. So I really think that, like, if he's going to keep on adapting, the small screen is where he'll get the audience, and you get the replay. A good TV series is like a good Christmas album. People keep on watching. People keep on listening. You make a lot of money off of that.
All right, let's shift the conversation over to what you've been playing with this week, Dwayne.
Gotcha. I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time. Pebble.
Yes.
Pebble had an update a while ago. I did not like that update.
You were not a fan in a big way.
I went from getting text messages and phone calls on my watch and playing a couple apps on my watch to getting every single push notification ever. on my watch, and it was at the point where basically Apple's mail would it fetches Google's mail. Apple's mail app fetches Gmail, and it would fetch it after half an hour or so, and I'd get about 30 different notifications on my watch that came through too quickly for me to read, and it was completely useless. I've had to change my behavior a little bit. I use Mailbox now. It gives me a push, so when I get an email, it comes in right away. But then also, they've added things like Do Not Disturb to the watch. So now when I'm getting, you know, like I'd have my phone on Do Not Disturb, but my watch would buzz at like 2 o'clock in the morning. Doesn't happen anymore. They have Do Not Disturb. I just you know, align those two functions. And now with notifications, you can make some choices. You can say, look, I want to get phone calls. I don't want to get anything. I want to get the push notifications. So you have some options. I'm hoping the granularity can become even more better.
Yeah.
Because my English just failed me right now. But I'm hoping that they can get a little bit more refined. You'll have just more choices there. But I
Are you willing to be a fan again?
I will say that, well, my biggest problem was when I first got my Pebble, I realized I couldn't live without it. And then I got the ad update and I realized that I couldn't live with it. And now I'm in a place where it's become useful again. It's not just buzzing every 5 seconds. You know, what I'm getting is the kinds of things that I want to do. The big problem with the Pebble is it's got two issues that make it different from a phone and make it so that you don't want to receive everything that you get on your phone on the Pebble. The first issue is the screen is read-only. And a read-only screen with limited amount of information before you have to move on isn't the same as looking at your lock screen on your phone where you can just move right into that app and right into that stuff.
Right.
The second is as a watch, you're simply unable to go into any real, you can't, you know, a notification should give you relatively good information. Getting a notification that says your friend just said something on Facebook and not giving me any information about what they just said is not helpful. or like this person, whatever it on Instagram, commented on Instagram, that's not a helpful notification. Whereas on my phone, it'll say this person commented on Instagram, it'll give me a little bit about it, yada, yada, yada. So yeah, I think the Pebble needs to find the place where it can really be all about its find a native way to display information for a watch. It can't just mimic a phone. It has to be different. It has to show, you know, it's an adaptation of what the phone is getting. Just like an adaptation of a movie, of a book in a movie is always going to be different. You know, the first Harry Potter film was awful, but it was exactly like the book. The second Harry Potter film was much better, but it was different from the book. The watch has to do the same thing. It has to find its happy medium between what it's trying to display to you and why that's relevant and why that's appropriate for your wrist.
And it's in that sort of like they're still in sort of the infancy stages. They're still feeling their oats.
It's the first season of Buffy, man. It's awful.
Yeah. Okay. Greg Davies, what have you been playing with this week?
I subscribed to the All Access premium version of Google Music this month.
Uh-huh.
And I am absolutely surprised at how awesome it is. They've come a long way since they launched the product. And when it came out, I jumped in for one of their trial runs.
Mm-hmm.
They were limited in terms of what their library was in the beginning. And the streaming functionality was not so hot when they first came along. Now the streaming is absolutely superb. You've got a very extensive library to choose from, and the times that I've come across artists that are not available tend to be the ones that have uber exclusive rights, such as your Led Zeppelins and your Beatles.
Sure.
Or very obscure bands that I've already got MP3s of anyway that I can upload. And so I'm really, really enjoying that at the moment. On the other hand, my Nexus 4 has been taking a backseat in the world of Nexus 5, unfortunately, because they've just launched that phone.
Mm-hmm.
They just pushed KitKat recently to the Nexus 4.
Mm-hmm.
How is that? How is that?
KitKat is fine on its own, but it broke Bluetooth.
Oh no!
Actually, what it actually did is it broke both wireless and Bluetooth. And the wireless functionality breaking is not really noticeable, but when it starts to break, it crashes Bluetooth.
When you say wireless, you mean like the Wi-Fi?
Yeah, Wi-Fi. Yeah. Right. So the Wi-Fi problem really isn't noticeable because it can recover itself. But when it starts to try to recover, Bluetooth takes a shit, basically, and it just
usually breaks. Those chips are both 2.4. So that those protocols are both hanging out on a 2.4 gigahertz antenna, and many computers and phones.
There is that aspect to it, and some people have reported some success with changing the frequencies and stuff. But
right, but they're usually on a phone. They're using the same exact chip.
This is actually a massive problem with Google Nexus 4 users at the moment. The support threads that they've got on this particular problem for this specific device numbers beyond 250,000 responses at this point since 4.4 was pushed out to the phones. And they've yet to come up with a fix for it. The only worker, see, what happens is Bluetooth crashes and you can't turn it back on. The only thing you can do is reboot your phone. So the only workaround is to turn wireless off while you're using Bluetooth on your phone.
That's kind of strange. Which,
it's not really a big deal for me because I really, the only thing I use Bluetooth for is for blasting some music. But I can understand how much of a pain in the rear that would be for people that use Bluetooth headsets while they're driving.
Or a Pebble.
Yeah, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, I could understand how it would be a highly frustrating situation for many, many people. So that's kind of the drama that I'm dealing with. So Google, you get a gold star from me this week, but you also get a black mark. So, yeah.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, I think about, you know, whenever something happens with Apple, there's a lot of, like, outspoken people, but the forums don't blow up that much because a lot of Apple users are just like, well, that's what Apple decided. Google's very different. I mean, I've had friends who are Apple diehards that, you know, because the developers eventually moved over to Android because they have more customization, more ability, right? And so the people who are writing to the Android forums are not only just showing up with anger, they're showing up with like, how could this have happened? Because right. I know something about how this works, and this didn't need to happen this way. And
right. Exactly. That's
significant, I think.
Exactly. And I mean, just to think of the numbers alone, I mean, the last time I looked at an article, it was reportedly 250,000 posts about this specific problem to the Nexus 4 forum. And not just in one thread, but in numerous threads. So that just the amount of people that this has affected is, in the history of Google, I think, is unprecedented.
Right, and let's remember that the Nexus is the flagship Google product. You get a Nexus.
Yes. Yes.
You get that because you get the updates faster. You get that because it's going to be supported by Google.
Right.
And it's a little disappointing to hear that's the three fundamental functions of any smartphone: GPS, Bluetooth, and Wi-Fi.
Right.
Right. Those are the three fundamental like places of connectivity. I mean, 4G, LTE, 3G. That's all very, very important. But the fact is, you're not spending your whole day away from Wi-Fi.
Right. The whole thing about Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, GPS access is what makes it a smartphone, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just a phone.
All right.
Yeah.
Why don't we move into some of our headlines here? We'll start with a big one here. Now, last week we talked about Google acquiring 7 robotics companies, and these companies had
they bought 7 robotic companies, you said.
That's right.
Well, that explains everything. That's why they're too busy buying robot companies instead of fixing my damn Nexus.
Well, I think maybe as Andy Rubin left Android, and so you know, all hell is broken loose.
Yes, there is that too. I'm sorry, I interrupted you, please.
So Google last week, Google bought 7 robotics companies, and they were all sort of like, they all had their functions, but none of them would be considered sort of groundbreaking in robotics, in the field of robotics. Like one of them made casters, like all they made were the little wheels for robots. Well, I think they were saving the best for last because last Friday, Google confirmed that it completed the acquisition of Boston Dynamics, which, as we know and we've mentioned on the show before, is the engineering company that's designed mobile research robots for the Pentagon. They gained an international reputation for machines such as the Big Dog, the Cheetah, the Wildcat, and the Atlas. These machines walk with an uncanny sense of balance and even run faster than the fastest humans It's the eighth robotics company that Google's acquired in the last month. Now, Google isn't saying exactly what they plan to do with their robot collection, but Boston Dynamics brings a significant cachet to their robotic efforts, which is, as I mentioned, being led by Andy Rubin, Google's former head of Android.
They are cornering this market.
Before we dive into the serious discussion on this, can we get the Skynet jokes out of the way? Yeah. You know it's inevitable. We've got to get them out of the way, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's clear that Andy Rubin, I mean, he's had robots in the brain forever. The operating system for the mobile devices is called Android.
Yeah.
Like, it's just what he's about. Sure. This is the, you know, his ability to, like, you know, realize his dream, I suppose. But by buying this many companies, they're setting a very high bar. And, you know, you do have to wonder about when it comes to stuff like, you know, general robotics.
Yeah.
What are they cornering the market? Is there an antitrust thing we have to do here? I do know that based on Google's behavior last week and this week, iRobot, the company that creates Roomba and Scuba and other household robot devices, in addition to devices that you may not know that the Defense Department buys, their stock has gone up by about 20%.
Has it really?
So Google has brought some light into the robot space. That's interesting.
Now, on that note, now we're aware of Boston Dynamics because of the work that they're doing for the government, the contract work they're doing for DARPA. Google executives said that they would honor existing military contracts, but they don't plan on becoming a military contractor on its own. So I think once their current research is done with the Big Dog and Cheetah, Wildcat and Atlas, they're going to let those contracts expire. And
I don't know. That's so much money that you can't just run away from that. I mean, also, there's the fact that the Defense Department could mandate you to be like, hey, we need these products supported and updated. And then there's the fact that, you know, Google said this kind of thing before. I believe the term was do no evil. I don't know.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think their idea, what they sort of intend to do with the robotics companies is build it like a new class of.
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Is that Terminator I hear in the background?
Yes. Yeah. Terminator 2's theme. Yeah, exactly.
Build a new class of autonomous systems that might do anything from warehouse work to package delivery and even elder care.
Yeah. Anything doing elder care is Will Smith 2004 iRobot, which I differentiate from Isaac Asimov 2000 robot.
Right.
iRobot. Right. You know, Skynet still applies, especially because Google's a cloud company. It's on everybody's computer. So yeah. Skynet completely applies to this. Are we supposed to be afraid? No. I think, in fact, here's my Skynet thought. We live at the perfect time for Skynet not to affect us. While the NSA has apparently been able to, you know, capture the information from billions of emails a day and so on, the vast majority of our systems aren't powerful enough to do things like power the kind of intelligence we see at Skynet unless software development just kind of like goes through a crazy revolution. So while we can have robots, and I have robots running around my house all day cleaning, iRobot type robots, I really feel like we don't have to worry because our systems are so stupid that when we're about, you know, 60, then we have to worry. So for now, let's live the good life and worry about that later. Kick the can down the road, I say. Mm. Just like we do with our debt.
Let the robots work for us.
Until they take us over.
The road to hell is always paved with good intentions.
My intentions aren't good. They're lazy.
You know what, dude? I've got to say, there's a couple of questions I have about this. And the first thing I have is... did we ever find out and work out for sure, without a shadow of a doubt, what Google was doing in those barges?
Oh, they're supposed to be for PR events because they don't want to just get like San Francisco space, and they don't want to get, you know, like the Yerba Buena Center or whatever. They want big ass parties that they can have, you know, for their whole team and, you know, for other big events. And they want that to happen on the barges. That's the cover story.
Do you buy that? I mean, now that they've announced that they've bought DARPA and they've bought all these robotic companies, I mean, it seems to me that maybe there's something a little bit more secretive going on.
That's
perhaps
the conspiracy theorist in me talking.
If they wanted those, though, they wouldn't keep them in the bay. They'd keep them in international waters.
Yeah,
but they're keeping them in the bay. They wouldn't keep them in the bay.
By the way, the harbor master has indefinitely grounded that project.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, the other question I have then is, with the recent PR slam dunk that Amazon did through via 60 Minutes.
Sure, the drones.
Was that a slam dunk, or was that, I mean, are people really, you think people are really buying that as real? You think it was good?
Of course it's a slam dunk. It's probably not real. It's a slam dunk. It's right before the Christmas season. Gets Amazon in the consciousness of the Christmas present buyers. You know?
Okay.
That's a PR thing. Is this perhaps Google's response to that?
It's too much money to respond to Amazon for that one thing.
You think so?
It's just too much. It's way too much money to respond to Amazon for that. For that, they would do something interesting with their devices that compete with Amazon's devices. But I don't think they'd be like, well, I think you could see it as a strategic counterpart to Amazon buying up. Like, you know, they could basically say, oh, man, Amazon's going to need to buy all the robotics companies in order to pull off this drone thing. We better buy them first. That I could see maybe happening in a long shot. But I can't see them being like, we need more presents during the Christmas season. Buy up all these robot companies. That's not what's going on.
Right, yeah. No, I think the motivation's different there. But like you said, though it's good PR for Google, it's got people talking about them.
Moving on, Sprint is working on a possible bid for rival T-Mobile, according to Wall Street Journal. Setting the stage for a giant telecom merger that, if permitted by regulators, would leave the U.S. wireless market dominated by three big companies. A deal could be worth more than $20 billion, depending on the size of any stake in T-Mobile that Sprint tries to buy. That's essentially a merger of the third and fourth largest U.S. carriers, and it would create a sizable competitor to Verizon and AT&T. Together, Sprint and T-Mobile would have nearly 53 million so-called postpaid subscribers. That would leave the combined company still a distant third to Verizon, which has 95 million postpaid subscribers, and AT&T with 72 million.
It's like boo and not boo. I mean, let's face it. Sprint and T-Mobile have a choice. AT&T tried to buy T-Mobile. That was blocked. If Sprint and T-Mobile do not get together, then we will not have three big telecom companies. We will have two big telecom companies.
Yeah.
So which one do you hate more? The idea that we have a Coke and Pepsi, or the idea that we have, you know, three different companies, a tripod that is not a triumvirate? Because I can guarantee you, if AT&T and Verizon are the only ones around, there's a pretty good chance that they'll figure out ways to work together to get the most out of customers as opposed to really compete. Mm-hmm. And Sprint's shown that they compete very well. You know, they were talking to Dish. You know, Dish was thinking, I could buy Sprint. I can take my Slingbox action and throw it over the wireless. I'd have my own spectrum. I can do whatever. Deutsche Telekom is like, hey, man, we're giving people 200 megabytes of free tablet data every single month. I mean, these are highly competitive ways of moving. And T-Mobile is one of the few companies in the U.S. who has a really good understanding, because of the German side, a really good understanding of the prepaid or the no contract mobile space, which is how this country is moving. This country is going to begin following the rest of the planet and moving toward the prepaid space. So I think there's an opportunity for some real like competition, possibly disruption, if these two guys have any clout at all, because they have no clout. That's the problem.
On the praise side of this, I can see where you're coming from. I'm a T-Mobile subscriber, and I've been thoroughly satisfied with their service. And I'm not being paid to say that, just so that you know. But every now and again, I will get a bad signal in the area that I'm in, and I could foresee if Sprint did acquire them, that would open up the connectivity for T-Mobile subscribers, because that then opens up their ability to use whatever Sprint facilities are in the area as well.
Well, there'll be some big growing pains because they're using fundamentally different technologies to communicate with their users.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. So I can see that. But at the same time, like, there's this loyalist aspect in me that just thinks, no, stay with it. Stick with it, T-Mobile. You can do it.
But the thing is, their parent company has wanted to sell them for years now. You know, like, they don't see traction in the U.S. I think the U.S., you know, they're Germans, and they're looking at it, and they're saying the U.S. market is not one that we want to compete in because we like a different style, because we can't dominate, because we'd rather austerity on this front, leave this market, focus on our native markets. Vodafone just got kicked out of the U.S. With Verizon's purchase, buyback of their stock. So, like, there's no space for Europe in the U.S. right now. And, I really feel like they're going to – they really want to just get rid of the property, which is why – I mean, it would be nice if T-Mobile were buying Sprint. I know, as a GSM lover, I'd appreciate that more, but this is not going to happen.
All right, moving on. Instagram announced last week a new feature called Instagram Direct, which will allow you to send videos and photos directly to friends and users of your – other users of your choice. When you open Instagram now, you see a new icon in the top right corner of your home feed. You tap it to open the inbox where you see photos and videos that people have sent to you. And to send photos and videos to specific people, tap that camera button to enter the same photo and video capture editing screens. Mm. Essentially, this is Instagram is getting into the Snapchat space.
You know, except you can save these photos and put them on 4chan.
Yes, they are. Like, the only difference is, yeah, Snapchat photos are destructive. You know, once you've watched them, they've disappeared completely, in theory. Instagram photos are still direct. You can send them to small groups or individual people. They're just but this is something that Instagram had never done before, and it feels like it's a response to the popularity of Snapchat.
I did see a submission over at Reddit of a screen cap of some guy that had sent out a picture of himself to his girlfriend, and the caption at Reddit, or the title at Reddit, said something along the lines of Instagram Direct doing wonders for doing wonders for relationships. Turns out that this dude had sent the picture of himself to all these other girls, and his girlfriend could see who they'd been sent to. So, doing wonders for relationships. Well done, Instagram.
Right, where Snapchat, the other recipients can't see. Like, you can only send it to one recipient at a time. Isn't that right? Or Snapchat, you can send to groups.
I think on Snapchat you can send it to bulk people, but I don't think they can see the recipients receive it, which is the big difference. I mean, Snapchat is allegedly big on the privacy thing, and a lot of people have fun with it. And I don't know about you, but I kind of dig the concept. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, like, you know, the old Mission Impossible stuff. You know, like, this message will self-destruct in 10 seconds. You know, it just adds that nice little fun element to digital communications that we've never really had before. You know, it's a nice thing to see Instagram going in that direction, though I think if they really want to remain competitive and relevant in comparison to Snapchat, they're going to need to add that destructive capability that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Instagram is interesting because they don't, you know, would this have happened if Instagram were still independent? No, it's under Facebook. Facebook tried to get Snapchat. It couldn't get Snapchat. Instagram Direct shows up. Instagram's all about nostalgia. Oh, yeah. Nostalgia is the opposite of deleting your stuff.
Yeah.
To chase down. So that's a crucial thing that they're going to have to
it's
chase.
It's also what Facebook does not want. They do not want you to delete your stuff.
Right. Like, so that's there's a piece there. Right. Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree with you there. Yeah. So that's a cultural thing that they want to deal with. Is Snapchat's one defining thing that you can destroy an image or destroy a message? It's actually not. I think that Snapchat just happens to be really fast, really helpful. And that's a great feature. It's a really helpful feature. But it's not the sexiness of the bikini. It's the ability of the bikini to let somebody use the bathroom without taking the whole bathing suit off. Right? That's what it is. You know what I mean? That's what Snapchat has going for it. If Instagram were to just immediately copy Snapchat, you know, they'd have a pretty good lawsuit on their hands, which could put Facebook could afford the lawsuit, absolutely. But, I mean, in public view and public opinion, the youth will be like, yo, 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 why are you just trying to cop on my Snapchat? And that's the opposite of what Facebook wants. The PR debacle will be a problem.
It's not unprecedented for Facebook to steal things, though. In their history, they have stolen concepts, and this
is... Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm just saying that now they're in the public eye in a way they haven't been in the past.
Right.
But this audience is one to fight for. No, you're right.
Bazillions. They can afford it. They can afford a settlement. You know.
No, it's not the settlement. I'm not talking about the legal ramifications. I'm talking about the public relations ramifications.
Well, you know, that's debatable because, I mean, Facebook is also facing a decline in the use of younger use by
that's true. Exactly what I'm talking about. If you're tween and they're stealing your shit, they're like, Snapchat is my jam. Facebook's trying to steal it. They tried to buy it. They said no because they're independent and cool. And then Facebook's trying to steal the functionality. I hate Facebook. I'm never using Facebook. That is what Facebook is worried about.
Well, it's really not that. I mean, the demographic is that. I mean, look, let's face it. I mean, Facebook has become more than a household name. Grandmothers and grandfathers are on it now. Your parents are on there.
We're not disagreeing. I'm just saying that because Facebook is this household name, right? They're suffering from the fact that the youth is moving toward Twitter and Snapchat because they want to coach it. They don't want grandma to see their posts. It's not about the post disappearing in 10 seconds. They just want to be on something different. If Facebook then jumps up and says, I'm going to copy Snapchat's functionality because I couldn't get Snapchat, there's going to be a PR problem where the young people are like, I don't ever want to use Facebook. Fuck them. Because Snapchat is my jam. They're at war with Snapchat. Well, Snapchat is my buddy. So for them to just jump in and see that functionality or just copy that functionality, they'd win any lawsuit or they'd settle any lawsuit or whatever. But at the same time, they would very much create enemies in an entire generation, which they cannot bear.
So I mean, they're already losing.
It's too much of a household name. Everybody and their mother's on Facebook. But people would leave Facebook if they thought that they were trying to attack something as cool as Snapchat.
Business Insider, actually, and I'll share this link with you guys, too. They posted a really interesting article. It's by one of their staffers over there. The headline read, Facebook is fundamentally broken product that is collapsing under its own weight. And, you know, it reads a little bit like a lot of the digital apocalyptic ramblings that you've seen before about, you know, the bigger they are, the harder they fall when it comes to tech companies and stuff like that. But it does address a lot of the issues that you're bringing up here, Dwight, and that is that a lot of the younger users are moving away because of not just the functionality but also the demographic, and they're going to suffer because of it.
Yeah, I think Facebook has a fundamental shift to make from... I think they have a brand shift to make. I actually think that the term Facebook needs to go away. They need to focus. No, I mean, I think you can keep the network, keep all the current functionality, but begin to realize you're not a Facebook. Mm. You're not a book of people's faces like you were in 2003. You've become something very different. And you have the ability to really, really do some good work in the world here. And by that, I mean, you know, you've got all this data, you've got all this demographic data. Now it's time to truly engage people. You know, keep the UGC going, but truly engage people. Do stuff like, I don't know, work with a company like Fitbit or some other quantified self company that allows me to have a private timeline and dashboard, one that I only see, that shows me how I'm doing in the actual world and allows me to share those bits with people, right? That's stuff like
patient client though that you're talking about there. That sounds like an interesting concept.
Right. So I mean they need to be able to like let people get the like the whole timeline thing is a brilliant thing. Now, instead of making everything kind of out there in public, how about we begin to take some of that and allow people to use like their comfortability? And I think people are comfortable with Facebook as a giant. Allow them, you know, speak to your demographic, allow them to take pleasure in some, you know, other media. Whether it's what you're watching or what you're doing with your body or whatever, and bring that in and fold your social events in with that quantified self movement, there's something there. Let's also look at like other things. They want more data. They've got a lot of money. Why not do something simple like buy a supermarket, buy Safeway, just buy it. right? Every single time someone uses their CRM card to get that coupon, you know exactly what they're doing. You're literally in charge of them feeding themselves. It sounds a little crazy.
Apply to become the leader of the NSA, please. Just, I'm begging you. I don't want to be followed.
What I'm saying is, if you're Facebook and you work with a company like Fitbit, a company like Safeway, you can suddenly give somebody a life plan to make their lives better. And you can help them share that across their friend circles or the world. You can get the kind of data that says, hey, look, over the course of these 50 years that we've been running, these people, these types of people have led more healthy lives than other types of people. So I can do stuff around that. Or I can do stuff to say, these healthy people, they're great. They could probably use a couple more bits of fat from McDonald's. Hey, you want to get in on that McDonald's? I'll help you out. Whatever. Like, I mean, it could be used for nefarious purposes, whatever. But they need the kind of data that's real and that matters. And they need to, like, maintain their, like, sharing of pictures, fine. But they need to really get into what really matters to people and be able to take that and leverage that in interesting ways. I mean, I don't know how to solve the world's problems in a day. I'm just throwing out some random ideas from having thought. I just feel like they need to focus again, refocus on meaningful interaction. That's what Facebook needs to do. That's what they've lost.
They actually have done. I know that they have done some restructuring and redesign, and I guess you probably would want to call them alphas, alpha versions of their revised product. Was used with a small amount of test users. And they all rejected them. The reaction from the users was extremely negative, and they decided to roll it back and not go with that particular restructuring, whatever it was. So they're obviously working on something. It'll be a big, you know, it's going to be a huge revelation when it comes out, and I can guarantee you that a lot of people are going to fucking hate it.
But, well, every single time Facebook changes something, people fucking hate it. Yep. That is like the cardinal rule of Facebook.
Yep.
You change it,
at
I
first,
hate it.
Yes.
I hate it for like, you know, that's just kind of how it is. And I really believe that when it comes to...
But that's the same with all social media. Like, if you even go back as far as the dig days, and Andy and I can testify to this, that any change that happens... to a site, especially if you're a power user of the site and you're very used to it, any change is usually met with harsh, harsh criticism.
And Dig was full of power users. You're not a power user on Dig.
But all companies suffer that. You know, Twitter...
Greg, that's actually an excellent segue.
Yeah,
next story.
Well, let's jump into that.
So on Twitter, if you blocked another user, that person could no longer follow your account, although they could still see your tweets. Twitter wouldn't tell other users that they'd been blocked. Well, last week, Twitter revised that policy, making it so any user you block can follow and view your tweets directly in their timeline. They can also favorite, retweet, and at reply to your account. You just won't see any of that activity in your timeline or your Connect tab. You also won't see anyone else who retweets, favorites, or follows block users. In effect, blocking another user muted them for you but changed nothing for them. As you might imagine, Twitter users were pissed off.
Oh, they were furious.
Yes,
they
with
were
that update.
Furious. And I, you know what? I don't blame them, because this just smacks to me of blocking people is not... profitable for us.
Yes.
And that's exactly the problem, because
the passive aggressive.
The moment you put a price on the ability to enforce your own privacy is the moment that your service is starting to break, in my mind.
Yeah.
And if you're
can
being,
you elaborate on that point?
Well, let's say, for example, like you know, you're being harassed. Or bullied, which is cyberbullying is another buzzword that floats around, by an individual. If you block them, then in the past, what would have happened is you wouldn't see their stuff. They wouldn't see your stuff. And so you didn't have to put up with their stuff at all. Whereas with their change, which has since been rolled back, the muting functionality, which enabled the person you blocked to still view your stuff or something along those lines. Let's say, for example, one of those parties is a person that, you know, worked for a company and some of the tweets that they put out there are about the products that they work on, and so essentially, in a lot of ways, it's there's a marketing element to what they're putting out there, and so that element of data gathering that Twitter does embrace as well as what Facebook does, probably not to the same extreme, is basically put at risk if it's under the old blocking scheme. But with the new one, they could still rip that data.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder, as an advertiser, how they feel about that. Hey, man, I'm going to allow you to advertise on Twitter. Great. I want to get this particular thing out to 215,000 users. Twitter's like, sure. Advertiser comes back. Wait, these 50,000 users have blocked me. I can't reach them anymore, even though they fit the Democratic profile, demographic profile. Twitter's like, oh, we'll make it so that your stuff gets out. Hey, users, I know you don't want to hear from this guy, so we'll just mute you. So,
but that's the whole point of their sponsored tweets, which you see on the apps. I mean, you know, even Tumblr does this on their mobile.
Advertisers don't like the sponsored tweets. Advertisers want more of an earned media thing. They want to be able to know that they're getting right onto you.
They want it to be immersed so it looks like a natural part of the social media environment, which is basically what the original social media marketers were kind of pushing for back in the early adopter days. And yet with what they're doing here is kind of like, well, we've kind of grown past that now, and to make it more profitable, we'll just change blocking. We'll redefine that to muting, so that the data is still out there. And even though these two people or this one person won't be able to see the other person's actions, other people can see those actions. And therefore, that's more data going around.
No, I think that's interesting. I just wonder what's going to happen when it comes to the deals they share with advertisers. Did these people see it or didn't they?
I'm not sure whether it's going to... I'm not really... At the end of the day, I don't think it's really going to affect... Twitter's marketing or advertising or anything like that. I really don't think that at all. I think what this is a big hit against the confidence that users had in their service, because the ability to block someone is really has been a native part of social media since its inception, really, when you think about it. Mm. I mean, the ability to block someone who is trolling you, harassing you or anything of the sort, or even spamming you for crying out loud. It's been a feature from the get-go. And to change it like this...
Since email, yeah.
You know, yeah, indeed. It's just a terrible move by the company. And it's one of those things that you probably could chalk up to the phrase, what the hell were they thinking?
Mm.
Yeah,
I think they were thinking that they could tell advertisers that people... weren't blocking them.
You know, they because of all the backlash, they announced later on that same day that they reverted the blocking policy back to the way it was before.
So they should.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They said we believe this is not ideal, largely due to the retaliation against blocking users by blocked users that often occurs. Some users worry just as much about post-blocking retaliation as they do about pre-blocking abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, ultimately, I think the customers, the consumers, the users have to dictate how the site is going to be used, or they vote with their feet and move on to another site that isn't.
Well, that's what I did with Facebook. I'm no longer using Facebook as a personal social media app. By any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. I do use it to post links to the Blendover podcast, but that's it. You don't see any status updates from me. I don't put photos on Facebook or anything like that anymore, because I discovered that the limitations that they place upon friend requests that you can send out to people is based upon an algorithm that they use. And so if you start stretching out beyond your
networks or whatever,
far beyond your networks, they will start sending you messages about you're blocked from sending friend requests for X amount of days.
Oh, is it because they want you to just get a fan page or something instead of like trying to be organic?
No, not at all. It's they don't want you to stretch beyond your natural networks because they have some tools in place that for marketing purposes that study how your friends and followers respond to your actions on Facebook. So, for example, you, Dwayne, as an influencer, if you click like on the Nickelback Facebook page...
That would never happen, but okay. Right.
Okay, but if you did, and the next day somebody who follows you clicks like on Nickelback, and then 6 months later another one of your followers clicks on that same link, then the algorithm determines that the person that you're a bigger influence on the person that clicked one day after you than the one who clicked 6 months after you. And so they target the advertising based on those actions alone.
Mm.
And so I've decided to remove myself from the Facebook equation, and I've moved my feet elsewhere to the likes of Tumblr, to the likes of Twitter, Google Plus.
Mm.
Probably so, a wise decision. And if you say, and if
I'm
we,
a big fan of Facebook, I'm not gonna lie. I'm not of the necessarily corporate practices,
yeah.
But as a person who doesn't live close to their family, because I'm in Boulder,
yes,
it's incredibly helpful to reach out to people and to have, you know, relatively good substantive conversations, especially when there's a post that I read at like 4 o'clock in the morning when I've woken up randomly. And I've got something to say about it.
It's great at what it does in that respect. That
the communication connecting factor is, I will admit, is a huge plus in the Facebook court. That being said, though, I've just had enough of them at this point, and I've moved elsewhere. So the only thing you'll ever see from me on Facebook is with relation to any podcasting that I do. That is it.
Yeah, so, I hear that. That makes sense.
All right, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week, the book I want to talk about is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. What could be more appropriate than that? Charles Dickens' classic tale of that miser of all misers, Mr. Ebenezer Scrooge, his cheerful and long-suffering assistant Bob Cratchit, and Scrooge's mysterious visitors on a wintry Christmas Eve, the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future, in a timeless story that is a universal reminder of what the holiday season can and should mean. And this particular link that I'm linking to is one that is read by Jim Dale, who was the voice, the narrator of all the U.S. Harry Potter Audible books, and a former major film actor, former film actor of a lot of kids movies, like he did a lot of Disney stuff back in the day.
Right. It's interesting because Charles Dickens, his Christmas Carol is a very popular tale. For me, it represents a big change in the way Christmas was viewed. Before Charles Dickens, I feel like Christmas was so focused on Jesus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And after Charles Dickens, you know, its focus is on the family, which is, if you're in America, that's a lot of what you hear celebrities and so on say when they talk about Christmas. Oh, Christmas is about kids. It's about family. It's about taking care of your family. It's about hanging out with your family. And the religious overtones were largely secularized by Dickens' tale, which was about, you know, let's treat each other in a certain way, you know, and that's what Scrooge learns. So I feel like it's a really interesting piece of work because it was incredibly popular. It put a different emphasis on Christmas, and while it's a classic and it's considered a traditional Christmas thing, it really is part of that movement.
Is this the book that was that's based on that movie with the Muppets and Michael Caine?
That's right.
No,
well, I mean, it spawned so many after it went to public domain. It spawned so many adaptations that you can't help but think about. I mean, that's what your point is, probably, that you can't help but think about Christmas without A Christmas Carol, which, again, you know, all this stuff is secularized Christmas, which helps out in terms of, I'm sure, economies and stuff. How many Christmas shows are there? How many bits of media are made on this?
Yeah.
But it also just shows you that Christmas and popular media have in many ways moved beyond the Christ message, the quote-unquote good news.
It's also, you know, this particular piece is a wonderful indication of the class of writer that Dickens was. I mean, he was really, I mean, he'll be highly regarded as Shakespeare in centuries to come. He's not quite up there yet, but you know, he's still highly regarded.
Well, Shakespeare founded the language through his work.
Yeah. But well, Dickens kind of did the same thing too, to a certain degree.
He wasn't adding words like the way on the level of Shakespeare was. Like the language wasn't a popularly spoken language until right around that
but
time.
But you know, what I will say is that Dickens built character development in a way that authors before him had not previously.
Right. Mm. Yeah, he was revolutionary for his time, and
revolutionary period. There's no doubt.
Yeah, he was also very good in that episode of Doctor Who. I was really happy to see him make
always taking
in that
it back.
Role.
I know,
and you know what?
Who.
He was so tolerant of Billy Piper's outfit that I really felt that he was the kind of man that
he
I
had the Christmas spirit. That's what it was.
Mm.
Exactly.
Okay, so. In order to take advantage of that offer, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you still get to keep the book for free, Christmas Carol. Or any other book that you choose. They're all great books. And Audible has some really nice deals around this time of year. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, are the NSA's activities unconstitutional? And will the Obama administration do anything about it? Take a listen to this and come on back.
God rest you, merry gentlemen. Let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ our Savior was born upon this day to save us all from Satan's power when we were gone astray. What tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. What tidings of comfort and joy. From God our Heavenly Father this blessed angel came, and unto certain shepherds brought tidings of the same, how that in Bethlehem was born the Son of God by name. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy. Oh, star of wonder, star.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and our guest, Greg Davies.
Hey, Andy, would you mind if I interrupt for just 1 second and talk directly to your listeners?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I just wanted to let people know this is round two. See, a long time ago when I was on the Drill Down with Andy and Duane. Duane and I went hammer and tongs at each other about this very topic we're about to talk about, and this is round two. So be ready. This is the highlight of the episode right here. It's coming. So be ready.
I feel like a little Rocky theme is in order. a little Rocky versus Apollo Creed.
I wish I had that cue. That would be perfect.
All right, so let's talk about there's a lot happened regarding the NSA this week. First and foremost, a federal judge ruled Monday that the NSA, the program which collects information on nearly all telephone calls made to, from, or within the U.S., is likely unconstitutional. U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon found that the program appears to violate the Fourth Amendment ban on unreasonable searches and seizures. He also said the Justice Department had failed to demonstrate that collecting the information had helped to head off terrorist attacks, which we've talked about before. We talked about, has this actually, you know, stopped any legitimate terrorist threat? He said, I cannot imagine a more indiscriminate and arbitrary invasion than the systematic and high-tech collection and retention of personal data on virtually every single citizen for purposes of querying it and analyzing it without judicial approval. His 68-page opinion is the first significant legal setback for the NSA's surveillance program since it was disclosed in June in news stories based on leaks from former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden himself praised the decision. He said, "I acted on my belief that the NSA's mass surveillance programs would not withstand a constitutional challenge and that the American public deserved a chance to see these issues determined by open courts. Today, a secret program authorized by a secret court was, when exposed to the light of day, found to violate Americans' rights. It's the first of many."
This is really a hollow win, a hollow victory in a lot of ways, because it looks good in the news. It looks really good in the news until you find out that the judge stayed his order to allow for an appeal.
He stayed his order for an injunction until such time as an appeal.
Right.
So he basically stopped them from he did not stop the NSA from moving forward. He did not stop the NSA. He did not say, stop in your tracks, stop collecting data, stop doing whatever, you know, pending an appeal. Instead, he said, hey, NSA, I'm not a fan, but the fact is I'm a middling judge. I'm middle management in the court system.
Right, yeah.
Therefore, we all know this is going to bigger people than me. So for me to put an injunction up would be toothless to begin with. And the fact is, if I put an injunction up and I'm found and my opinion's found incorrect, then legally that injunction, he would be safe. But legally, that injunction would have been considered to have threatened the country, which is why he didn't move. He's like, basically he's like, as much as I don't think this is a good idea, spending X amount more months, and now that it's in the scrutiny of the light of day and everything like that.
He's got to pick his battles.
Exactly.
Right. But I think the biggest advantage about this particular situation, and Dwayne, this is one of the topics that we weren't at odds with when we spoke about this last time, and that was as techie geeks, we are right into this, and we've been into this for years, and we know that it's been going on, and we've been very opposed to it. But the problem that we've been running into is, how do you let this catch fire in the mainstream? How do you simplify this so that the people understand it a little better and are able to stand up and oppose it? And in this case, by putting this ruling out there in the ether and the coverage that it's been getting in the last week is, I think, a first step into simplifying the message for people out there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, rallying people around this issue is definitely a thing. I mean, there's two things going on here. There's obviously this judge and his review constitutionally of what's going on. But then, I mean, I don't know, Andy, if you're ready to go into the next piece.
Sure.
But there are other people who have been given some authority to pass judgment on this that have also thought that this goes against what the public is about. And do we want to get into that story? Or do we want to
absolutely. The top leaders of the world's biggest tech companies.
I mean, it's actually, there's threefold. We can get into all of them. There's the top leaders of the world's biggest tech companies. There's this judge. And then there's Obama's independent commission.
Right.
Not unlike the Warren Commission, that he assigned, hey, take a look at this. What have you got? What opinion have you been able to make regarding what's going on with the NSA?
Right. Well, now, let's take it chronologically. So before that report was released, the top leaders of the tech companies met with President Obama. And the intention was to sort of talk about a wide range of tech topics, including improving the functionality of healthcare.gov, amongst other matters. And, you know, the leaders of these tech companies formed a unified front. And one of them even said, you know, that's not going to happen. We are here to talk about the NSA. There's only one subject that people really want to discuss right now. And so they met with President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden.
And when we say top tech companies, why don't you run down which technology organizations were present here?
It was Google, Yahoo,
Twitter, Facebook. Were they on there?
Twitter, Facebook, and one more that was interesting. not necessarily what many consider a technology company, but a company that is completely in touch with the technology, and that's AT&T. Verizon was, interestingly enough, not present, but AT&T was there.
Netflix.
Surprised me that AT&T were there, because, I mean, they've been complicit in this surveillance since...
They've been complicit because of the laws that were passed, not unlike when... They were being complicit because laws that were passed in front of their face and said, hey, you can't talk about it, you can't do it, you can't do whatever. Mm-hmm. They were complicit, as Verizon was complicit. AT&T, in many ways, this is a PR move. In addition to, you know, them being outraged, saying, we don't want this either. This traffic is, you know, this traffic is being monitored across our network. We do not want this. And we're here to say that as well. And that's, I think that's significant, that they were going to take, we may be dumb pipes, but we're not stupid.
Right, which is, it's actually a stark contrast to the recommendations made by the panel today, which I'm sure Andy will explain in a moment, because their recommendation was leave the gathering of information to the private companies, essentially.
Well, in many ways, I can imagine AT&T saying, look, we have all this information, and if you have a court order to subpoena it from time to time based on, like, a credible threat, then fine. We'll do what we need to do to give it to you. But the idea that you just take it from us, information that we've spent our money gathering, that we've built infrastructure for. I mean, the thing about the NSA doing this is, unlike every other government program, no one's getting paid. So let's think about it from – let's just follow the money a little bit. Any other government program that uses private contractors to get its stuff done, the government has to pay out. The NSA is basically quartering their troops inside the houses of these companies, which – is an amendment.
Illegal search and seizure.
It's basically saying, well, I mean, the quartering of troops, I think that's the Third Amendment. You can't put your troops in someone else's house. And that's what they're doing. That's literally what they're doing in these companies. And they're like, look, if I need to, I mean, I'm sure as much as they're like, hey, you know, this is messing, you know, where's the value here? It's messing with my audience. It's messing with my users. There's really negative value there. My users are leaving me. Europe has already said that they're looking for alternatives to Gmail, and they're having commercials on TV saying, don't trust Gmail, the NSA is watching.
Are they really? Yeah, they are.
It's a catastrophic, you know, PR mess for companies that were not necessarily complicit or like willfully complicit in this issue. And Europe is always looking for a way to move their users, you know, off of American products and onto their own. That's why, you know, Opera's still around. The only reason why Opera's still around. So what's happening here is that, you know, users are like, what the hell? And in Europe, they can really be what the hell. Meanwhile, China is like, you know, China's used to doing this anyway. And it's we've constantly said we're not China. Google left China because of this very type of issue. And Google's suffering from this here in the U.S. Right. Now, the government has a couple choices. They can say, okay, guys, we're going to strike a deal with you that allows us to, like, talk more openly about it. Okay, we're going to, like, get this data from you. We're going to pay you for it or whatever. But the fact is, it's a shit deal. It's a shit deal. It's an abuse from a private industry perspective. Just me speaking as a business-conscious dude that is, you know, maybe hanging out on the more conservative side of this particular conversation, it's a shit deal. It is, you know, like, from a libertarian perspective, it's awful. From a business first perspective, it's awful. From a constitutional perspective, it's awful. It's just awful. You know,
it only benefits one side in this fight, and that's the NSA.
And we don't even know if it's truly benefit. Like, to what end is it benefiting them?
Right.
Are they really able to do things that are helpful to the general, you know, the general population?
That's all concealed. Right. You know, and I think the biggest problem that people are having, and there's another article in the show notes that I'm not sure if we're going to go into detail about, but I'm sure, Andy, you might want to put it in the show notes because I'm sure your listeners will be very interested in reading it. And it's actually an account by a former employee of the NSA. And he praises the NSA, and he goes on to state that the contractors and employees that have used these services for personal gain or blackmail or inappropriate use that were terminated or whatever the case may be were very far and few between. But the problem with that is that the American public need to know what those people have done and why, and
the fact that it happened once.
Yes,
there's no safeguard. There's nobody's watching the Watchmen in those case.
Exactly, and they say
Edward damn Snowden.
You begin
to wonder. You know, I mean, I'm not going to go into the hero or hurtful debate necessarily.
Sure, sure.
But you begin to wonder, you know, there were obviously people who used this information for their personal gain. And then you look at Edward Snowden, who's a 29-year-old making $200K on top of the world, you know, girlfriend, you know, ability to buy any reasonable apartment he wants. He's, you know, he's making serious money without even a graduate education. And he gives all that shit up to expose this. Now, did he want fame and fortune? Who knows? Who knows if he'll get that? It's unclear. But what is clear is that whether he's full of fame or infamy, he's exposed this to a point where you've got judges, presidentially appointed panels, and major
tech companies, major
tech guys looking at this, and you have to ask yourself, he's the guy who did not, he's the guy who went out on a limb to do perhaps what he thought was right. What about all the people who just wanted to abuse this, of which we know there are very, very many more, right? There are more people who wanted to abuse this.
Exactly. And then there are some public cases of this as well. And I mean, the most provable, of course, was the and this did come out from Snowden before he came out as the guy that leaked it. But it was the news that the NSA had been monitoring the calls of journalists. And that was like the first publication. I think it was from the Washington Post, if memory serves. But even before that, you may recall that General Petraeus,
right,
got done for having an affair with that woman that was writing an autobiography, and the way that they were communicating was via draft messages in a Gmail account that they shared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now,
They didn't. The best part about it, they never sent the messages, so there were no IP records about that. It was just about how it was accessed.
And the only group that could have gone into that would have been the NSA, theoretically, if you go by what we know of them.
But what's the NSA's motivation in having Petraeus leave as opposed to using Petraeus as a puppet?
We know that there's always interagency warfare going on. There's always kind of this rivalry between the CIA and the NSA. It's been going on for decades. You know, and so that's probably where it all comes from.
But yeah, I get that. But I'm just saying, I just think strategically and Machiavellianly, I look at Petraeus and I'm like, dude, I can ruin your life, or we can share more information based on an agreement that we put together that favors me.
I think you put the nail on the head there. It's
Petraeus just said suddenly, I'm going to quit and I'm going to expose myself because he's that he's got that much integrity.
And historically. Historically, that tactic worked like gangbusters for J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. I'm just saying, I feel like if that were the case, Petraeus would have been like, okay, let's see what we could work out, rather than saying, okay, let me expose all this stuff, ruin my entire personal life and whatever, and then not expose the NSA. Mm-hmm. That's where my problem with that theory is.
Right. Yeah, I understand that. But basically, I mean, without trying to get into those separate issues as a separate debate, mm-hmm. I'm trying to highlighting that these are the only public versions that we know of, public versions of abuse that we know of, that may have originated in the NSA. Mm-hmm. So what else is going on?
Yeah, no, I agree there that there needs to be a deep and penetrative look at NSA activity, personnel, and so on to understand what sort of damage has been done to the American people. And that's the kind of probe that I think Congress, frankly, has been too afraid to even think about doing until the presidential panel came out today and said, hey, we need to make sweeping changes to the way NSA collects this information.
Yep. Exactly.
And to which senators are not congressmen. Senators have 6 years in. They're usually a little bit more they just think a bit longer out. And several of them, on both sides, one of them being Rand Paul from Kentucky, a huge conservative, said, you know what? These guys are in agreement with my constituents. These guys are showing us, the press, you know, us, the Congress, and the press, and the world, that this is not behavior that can be condoned by a country such as ours. And that's Rand Paul talking.
Yeah.
Rand Paul is a very difficult person when it comes to populism. So it's an interesting take. You know, there's people coming. It reminds me a lot of where I live in Colorado. The reason why we have legal marijuana is because conservatives don't like the government telling you what you can and cannot do, and liberals think that marijuana is clearly the kind of drug that doesn't require hardcore law and order. And that's what's happening here. Conservatives and liberals are coming from either side saying, from conservatives are saying, it's taking away my freedom. I can't talk about what I want with who I want and have that freedom. Liberals are saying it's a constitutional problem and law and order should not be, you know, so harsh and everything. And I think that might cause the kind of catalyst that really gets something done. Now, this Congress is known for not getting things done. We'll see what happens next year when some of these congressional appointments change. But I really feel as if we're in a position where something could happen to change very much the way the NSA is collecting this information, because it's multilateral pressure coming from many fronts.
I would like to hope that Glenn Greenwald and Edward Snowden
get together in Brazil
and their cabal of people that have the cache of information that they've yet to release. I would hope that within the information that they've yet to reveal is actual transcripts or, you know, of a phone call or something involving, you know, a high-profile senator or someone in government or something along those lines, because then it would really drive it home to them. You know?
I guess so, but that also puts in personality as opposed to process. And I think one of the big problems here is that one of the good things about this is that this is not something that's easily scapegoated onto one senator or one person running the NSA. This is a systemic failure. And in order to keep it a systemic failure, we need less in the way of villains and heroes and more in the way of laying out that these organizations were fundamentally put together by a nasty Congress and a nasty FISA court to enable the NSA to do a nasty thing.
So the transcript was involving, say, General Alexander and revealing something not so nice that he was doing under the guise of the commander of the NSA.
Well, I mean, maybe. I think the good thing here right now, the positive thing, is that it's a systemic problem. There were multiple organizations involved and not just a guy like J. Edgar Hoover pulling the strings. I think that's a very good thing for making sure that this isn't that we can look at it from a global perspective and make sure that the controls can be put in place, not to attack the types of people, the very people who did this, but the systems that allowed this to happen, you know, put those kinds of controls in place.
Yeah.
I really think that's one of the key positive things here. I also have been made to understand from Fox News Sunday and from the Fox News Sunday interview that there may very well be a cache of information which Edward Snowden is holding close to his chest that will only be released upon his death or his abduction, and that cache of information is some of the more quote unquote dangerous information for the government to have leaked, the explosive vest on his chest in case anyone tries to take him.
The
former NSA head was on with Chris Wallace a Sunday ago, and he revealed that Chris Wallace asked the question, have you heard this? Do you believe it's true? And the former NSA head said, yes, I do believe it's true. I believe that that's exactly what we have here. So,
I can't imagine a cache of information that has been more damning, that would be more damning than what has already been released up until this point.
Well, I mean, that just means your imagination is big enough. There's so many things. I mean, if what Greg is talking about has transpired, if several separate individual personalities were using this information incorrectly, or information about any nefarious or salacious activities had occurred and the NSA had those and Edward Snowden was able to pull that out or whatever, that level of threatened, overarching, let's call it blackmail, is enough to keep him from doing something. Now, if he gets to Brazil, Edward Snowden, and let's just say, I mean, there's the I'm going to take a little tangent here. There was a big train robbery that happened in 1960-something in England. A couple thugs basically found out the Royal Mail truck train had a whole bunch of banknotes that were ready to be retired. So you're
talking about Ronnie Biggs, who died this week.
Exactly. Ronnie Biggs died. What Ronnie Biggs did was, you know, he did the big train robbery. You know, he got caught. He went to jail. And then he escaped and got to Brazil. And the British government was like, okay, Brazil, let's send him over. Brazil was like, you know what? He got a young lady pregnant here, so he's going to be the father of Brazilian national. We can't extradite the father of Brazilian national. Brazilian nationals need to have both parents when we can help it. And I don't know if those laws have changed. But, I mean, Edward Snowden, Brazil, women.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about that for just a second here. Now, Edward Snowden, he wrote an open letter to the people of Brazil appealing for basically appealing to help them uncover the
depths to which the NSA has infiltrated Brazilian, you know, national security and all those things.
He said in his letter, he dismissed U.S. explanations to the Brazilian government and others that the bulk of metadata gathered on the billions of emails and calls were more data collection than surveillance. He said, there's a huge difference between legal programs, legitimate spying, and these programs of dragnet mass surveillance that put entire populations under an all-seeing eye and save copies forever. These programs were never about terrorism. They were about economic spying, social control, and diplomatic manipulation. They're about power.
This is a new example, a resurgence of Kissinger's real politic. Let's understand what's going on in that country so we can make sure to keep it off balance, off whatever, in order to maintain that American power so that the American way of life is maintained. Even now, you know, extensive studies by, you know, media organizations like NPR's Planet Money have shown that many of the things that we have in this country, t-shirts is how they've really been tracking it, are directly tied to you know, how poor can we maintain a labor force? You know, how much can we maintain a labor force at the bare minimum of what they need to survive in order to have good, like, nice goods in our country for really inexpensive prices? Surveilling all these countries, understanding what's going on in these countries so that we can make economic policies that keep these countries' people in places where they don't have the capital or resources to determine their own destiny is something that, you know, we have to worry about. Now, is that happening? I don't know. Edward Snowden's charges is a big assertion that you know, assumes a lot of integration with government and non-governmental agencies that I don't really think is occurring. But then again, I'm the kind of guy who needs data in front of me in order to really do whatever. But the fact is, our economy in many ways, especially when it comes to the produced goods, is based on other countries' economies not functioning efficiently or having political systems that keep the economies from functioning efficiently. And if we're surveilling to get an understanding of how they're doing stuff, that puts our CIA in a position to do field operations that would disrupt these countries.
Well, I mean, they've always done that. I mean, historically speaking, there's evidence to suggest they've done that for even well before Kissinger's time. You know, there's a lot of historical evidence out there for that. That being said, though, like, I was just thinking, mm-hmm. as opposed as we are to the NSA's indiscriminate spying, shall we say, is as opposed as we are to that, there's a possible result from this that a lot of people I don't think have anticipated yet, and that is, if the American people are successful at saying no, we don't want this kind of conduct being done anymore, mm-hmm. Then the possible result from that is that this kind of surveillance just digs even further underground.
Well, that's why I'm focused on this idea that it's not about personalities. It's about creating systems that stop this systemically. Now, one of the things that's a big deal here is it's very hard to keep a big situation like this secret. It was one of the reasons why it got out eventually, because someone's not going to drink the Kool-Aid and they're going to keep it secret.
Right. So
Edward Snowden, it was a perfect example. And the thing about him is that he's not a he didn't swear an oath to the government. Now, could it go deeper? Absolutely. If someone does something, if they change their contractor position so that you can't be a contractor and get access to this stuff, you have to be one of those people in the NSA who swore an oath to the government and yada, yada, yada. But eventually all this stuff, you know, someone sacrifices, and the arc of history has shown that you just can't keep these kinds of conspiracies locked down too much if this is indeed a conspiracy. So that's something to think about. It's difficult for this to go deeper because, I mean, stuff like the FISA court was already pretty deep. The existence of the court itself was secret.
Yeah.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And the fact that the court itself, we have to wonder about. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States gets to appoint every single one of the judges. There's basically a club based on that Chief Justice's political understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird. That's not normal. So it's right. One thing to have judges go through congressional review because we have a representative democracy. It's another thing to say the guys making the decisions about your privacy did not go through congressional review. Only one person did, and he's not even on that court. He gets to point people to it.
It's the lack of public accountability that really disturbs me. And I mean, obviously, I mean, look, I'm not worried about whether the NSA is sucking up my email and finding out what kind of, like, you know, stalky emails I've been sending to that blonde down the street. I'm not worried about that. I mean, what I am concerned about is the precedent that it sets for abuse within the system and the lack of public accountability for that. Because technically these people represent the people of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you had a country like the UK, where you only get to vote for one half of one branch of the government, you don't get to vote for the Queen, you don't get to vote for the House of Lords, you don't get to vote for the judges, you can only vote for your congressman. I can see this kind of thing showing up. But in this country where you have to vote for every damn person, and then they figure out a way to get such widespread, let's call it abuse, you know, taken care of without, you know, vote representatives on there, judges who are basically immune from any kind of rapprochement unless they commit a felony. That's a difficult thing. That's painful.
Well, let me ask you this, guys. I mean, because we're probably getting ready to transition to the next part of the show.
Yeah. But,
you know, where do you – and I could be treading over already discussed ground here because I know you did your year-end review recently. But where do you see this issue with the NSA going in 2014?
Well, you know, before this week's events, I would have still been complaining about the frustration of the lack of sort of the American public in
the lack of traction in pushing it forward.
Yes.
Yeah, and the fact that the media somehow decided to make the story about Edward Snowden and not about the actual issues at hand.
Yeah, but after this week's events with both the major tech companies pressing their point, the panel pressing its point to the Obama administration, and the judge Leon's ruling, I think there's a stronger case here that it would have to be, you know, now it's in Obama's court to defend why the NSA should continue to act the way they've been acting.
Well, if he's a bright guy, and he's a bright guy, it's going to not necessarily just fall to him. He's going to be able to say, you know, I inherited this. He did. He inherited it from what's arguably the worst president in living memory, aside from Ronald Reagan. There, I said it. He's going to be like, I inherited this. And it's clear that the American, you know, that the times have changed. We don't live in a 9/11 world anymore. We live in something a little bit different. And we have to make changes. And that's where his strength can come from. Especially when it comes to rallying his base. because you can be assured that the liberals are not behind this particular thing. And I think the neocons, which are completely out of power in the face of the Tea Party and regular conservatives, this is a legacy that can be put on top of them. That the Tea Party conservatives and that the erudite liberals can look at and be like, this is a neocon thing. Let's get rid of it. Or let's change it. Let's make it, you know, more public. Maybe it's going to end up that, hey, the NSA is going to look at everything you do. If you want, you can request what the NSA has got on you. Maybe it's going to be something like that. But the fact is, it should change if he wants to maintain popular support and political clout.
Well, especially with you know, the elections coming up next year, and you know, then you've got the presidential elections in 2016 as well.
And if his legacy needs to be secure, if his legacy needs to be secured, he needs a Congress that's going to help now, and he needs a president that's going not to like reverse everything he's done.
I'm not as optimistic as you are about him possibly making this a win for him, but simply because of his track record, the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than any other presidency in history combined.
Well, the trick is, again, to not make this about Snowden, to make this about the fact that this is a system that he inherited and that it was in, you know, it's a neocon-based system focused on a post 9/11 mentality that is no longer necessary in the wake of a shutdown war with Iraq and a shutting down war with Afghanistan and a closing of Guantanamo Bay. You know, like, he's just turning off neocon policies left and right. Why not turn this one off?
Well, or at least change the thing, like the neocon thing, even bringing that up brings up a cult of personality. It also brings up ideology. And that's probably a losing battle there. Well, what needs to be done is that this needs to be colored in shades of right and wrong.
Well, that's not going to happen, though.
I would like to see it happen.
You can't put it in right and wrong. You can say – that's like saying that the Pope is going to be okay with gay marriage. That's just not going to happen. What's going to happen – what could happen, what's possible is that, you know, you color it as something from a time, you know, bygone, right? And that you flip it and you say, hey, this is what used to be. And now we're going to look at something that's just going to be a bit more open, a bit more whatever, what we still have to collect data. Or we're going to use the telephone companies to collect it. And we'll drop summonses on the telephone companies and subpoenas on the telephone companies when we need the information. This a middling solution will occur is what I'm saying.
Just before we do move on, I watched a movie last night in which Edward Snowden made a cameo at the end of the movie.
Really?
It was a documentary, and it's called Terms and Conditions May Apply. Is a film that mainly focuses on the terms of service of the companies.
The EULAs.
The way that it's structured, it does move towards this year's NSA issue that has been a dominant area of discussion in the tech world this year.
This is something we've been talking about on this show forever. This idea of terms and conditions.
Yeah, you need to see this movie. It's actually quite interesting to watch. It's nothing that you don't know about already, being in the tech sphere. But it'd be enlightening for a lot of people that are just casual users. But it's just one of those things that kind of reaffirms your outlook on the way the companies are handling big data now.
Well, and big data is a profit center for sure, and they're going to do whatever they need to do. And also, with every single one of these companies, here's the thing. It doesn't matter what they say they're going to do with your data. Every single one of them has a clause that says your data will be exposed to whomever it needs to be exposed to in the event of a court order.
Right.
Which is why the NSA thing is so upsetting, because no court order was truly issued in order to get the mass collection of this data.
No, it's kind of loosely based on interpretations from the Patriot Act.
Yes, you know,
it's
another neocon piece.
Exactly, and that's another thing as well. Like, I mean, that whole thing needs to be like taken out. The whole thing needs to be rewritten. You know, it's just really, really, it's not a good state of affairs. And I'm very surprised that you and I are not going hammer and tongs this time. Very disappointing round two. So maybe we'll have to aim for a round three.
Anyway. Yeah, perhaps. I'm sure there'll be more NSA revelations in 2014.
Probably. I would hope so.
So we're going to take one last break here. And when we come back, everything is a remix, especially your iPhone. Our drill down video of the week is next. So take a listen to this and come on back.
I said a hip. The hip to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie to beat. Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat, and me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang bang the boogie to the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the bang bang boogie. Let's rock. You don't stop, rock the rhythm, that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard my voice, but I brought two friends along. And next on the mic is my man Hank. Come on, Hank, sing that song.
Check it out, I'm the C-A-S-N, the O-V-A, and the rest is F-L-Y. You see, I go by the code of the doctor of the mix, and these reasons I'll tell you why. You see, I'm 6'1", and I'm tons of fun, and I dress to a T. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously. I got bodyguards, I got two big cars that definitely ain't the whack. I got a Lincoln Continental and some new Cadillac.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Greg Davies. Okay, so let's get into our Drill Down video of the week. This is a part of a series known as Everything is a Remix. And in fact, we want to recommend the entire series as a whole because it's incredibly fascinating. First of all, let's talk about what this Everything is a Remix series is in particular. This comes from a filmmaker named Kirby Ferguson. And what he's done with this video series is he essentially traces back the roots of creativity. His overlaying a thesis is that creativity is a combination of stealing, lifting from other sources, and remixing it, and creating something new from that remixed source.
Right. It's a theory that's longstanding in any kind of literature-based perspective, mm-hmm. which is to say there are themes that exist that, you know, were original. And the themes that come out now, the ideas that come out now, are usually in some way related to those original themes, twists on them, changes right. of them. The idea that even with science, which is a fundamental aspect of, you know, technology and everything, technology being the understanding of mankind and the world, not just sure. like gadgets, but all of it is built on the shoulders of what came before.
Yes.
And
yes.
how you get there typically happens not by simply saying, oh, okay, I'm just going to think of something new.
Yeah.
Creativity itself is a process that is intergenerational. That's why everything is a remix. Everything
Could you imagine how advanced we would be now if the Library of Alexandria never fell then?
Exactly. We'd have that knowledge and we wouldn't have to rediscover it.
The foundation upon which we could have built stuff on top of that, that would have been brilliant. But, you know, that's another discussion for another time. But I totally agree with you guys. It's basically what you're discussing here is humanity. We have a tendency to build upon what is already established.
And there's this cult of, and there's this weird cult mm-hmm. that says, you know, you got a guy like Steve Jobs and he just was brilliant. He was crazy creative. You get the Beatles and those guys, clearly they just like invented all the music that they made. Mm-hmm. And this idea, especially in the Western world, that we have heroes and these heroes are people who were just everything about them was completely original and that everything else, you know, post them is whatever. Now, these heroes that we mentioned often have the media and history and victory behind them. And I'm not saying that any of the people that I mentioned are not heroes. But the cool thing about Everything is a Remix is that it helps you break down the difference between a ripoff and a remix. Mm-hmm. And that helps you then move into creativity. The four or five main episodes of the piece are about between like 7 and 13 minutes long. And you begin to understand how almost everything you've seen has a root in something else that you may not have seen. Yep. But that doesn't mean it's bad.
Right. He starts off sort of easy, like eases you into it with the whole, with the origin of the word remix itself, which came out of from music culture. And he talks about remixes and ripoffs in music, and how essentially his proving out his theory, creativity in music would be impossible without previous works as inspiration or as jumping off points for modern pop pieces. And you know, I have to say that this. Watching this series, I got this sort of sense of deja vu, and it wasn't until earlier today that I put it together. This reminds me a lot of a brilliant series from the late 70s called Connections, which was hosted by a man named James Burke. And essentially, James Burke's Connections was about talked about making the connections from technological innovation all the way to the technological innovations that we are familiar with in modern day. For example, like he traces the invention of the film projector way back to the invention of the Canon. He shows us how one invention led to another and inspired another and then spun off into something else. It's a brilliant series. I think it's probably available on Netflix. But Kirby Ferguson's "Everything Is a Remix" reminds me of exactly that, in that sort of detailed way that he's laid it all out. And he's got a new series coming out called "This Is Not a Conspiracy Theory." Which I'm looking forward to.
He's designing this especially for me.
Apparently so.
No, up until today, I was a virgin to the Everything Is Remix series. So today was my cherry popping moment of the Kirby Ferguson works.
Wow, you said cherry popping on air. Wow. Yeah.
Yes, I did, of course. Anyway, that being said, I was thrilled to see his next project being This Is Not a Conspiracy Theory, because, as you know, I'm a real fan of digging into, unexplained elements in history and looking at both the skeptic explanation and the conspiracy theorist explanation. And what you tend to find is that there's this middle area that's in gray that is probably closer to the truth than either of the arguments. Mm-hmm. And so I like analyzing both of those. And so anything like this is right up my alley.
Yeah. I mean, Everything Is Remix is very powerful. And I think especially in this sort of end of year time, the end of 2013, a lot of the podcasts that you guys are listening to are winding down for the year. People are going to spend, possibly Christmas, definitely New Year's kind of on the end. If you want a bit of content to watch, it's free. I encourage you to donate, but it's free to watch. It's online. It's on YouTube. And it's an interesting way to look at our culture, whether it's pop culture, geek culture, whatever culture, an interesting way to look at our culture and the technology we have with it, and to see some of the problems that he anticipates based on this idea that everything is a remix. So what happens when you run into things like intellectual property, which he breaks down succinctly, possibly more succinctly than we do on this show. So the whole thing is worth watching. But there's one video in particular that focuses on gadgets, which I think, Andy, you've chosen for this week's Drill Down Video of the Week.
Yes, and this one is called Everything is a Remix Case Study, the iPhone. And essentially, you know, many people, us as well as many people, in least of which being Apple themselves, have praise the invention of the iPhone as a revolutionary technology, and Everything Is a Remix essentially breaks down how there's nothing new in that invention, that it's the culmination of a number of different technologies that have evolved and have been remixed in certain ways, in particular like the multi-touch screen, which was a new application to a portable device, but had been in development since the 80s as a large format technology.
Actually, yeah. more poignant than that, I thought, Andy, was the section on that about design, the design aspects that went into the like how this thing was going to display on screen and how people were going to become familiar with the interface, mm-hmm. and how a lot of that design was based on already pre-existing elements of life and technology.
Sure. You
know, from a light switch to a typewriter.
Right.
And that's how you get this idea of skeuomorphism, which everyone seems to be running away from today. This idea of like, well, we don't need that thing to have leather on it, or we don't need the button to be right. tactile looking because it's not tactile. But you can only get one place from another place.
Yes.
And if you're trying to introduce your product to people who've never seen yep. this kind of thing, you end up with confusion and frustration. Yeah. You can either end up with confusion and frustration and the burden of informing people about how it should be, or you can say, let's create a bridge.
Yep.
Just like how we're talking about with cars and gasoline or electric, let's create a hybrid. Let's create something that everybody can understand and make use of, and then eventually we can move over to something that's more native to this particular device format, understanding, paradigm.
I love that point that he was making, that skeuomorphism was a sort of a necessary in-between stage that in order to familiarize people to the new technology. And he gave the example of the horseless carriage, the automobile. The very first automobiles were designed to look like carriages, like horse-drawn carriages.
Well, it wasn't even just designed to look like that. That's all they had. That's all they had in their brain when they thought about mm-hmm. what they were trying to achieve. We want a carriage that's horseless, and then it becomes a car. From carriage, car, auto car. It's automatic. Now we have cars, but you just can't get there without starting somewhere. You can only start what you know about.
Isn't that what Newt Gingrich calls smartphones? The horseless telephone.
He would.
That's
well, even in China.
Reference. If there's any meme watching people out there, you would have got that. But
if you look in Chinese Mandarin, the term for bicycle or motorcycle is the iron horse. Because again, that paradigm of this is how you travel: you straddle an animal and you move forward. The iron horse is the metallic version. You straddle that thing and you move forward. It does what a horse does, and that's how. It's one of the historical things is you see this always in language, and people get a little annoyed at it because they're like, why does something mean something else? Because they've kind of forgotten or it hasn't been explained to them, you know, why the word enough is spelled enough. It used to be pronounced enoch because our language is highly Germanic, and that was just part of it. And until you get those understandings, until you get that breakdown, a lot of things don't make sense. Once you do, you begin to see pieces of everything all over the place, and it's a wonderful way to begin to experience the world anew. And so, yeah, this is a great video.
All right, let's wrap up our show this evening by going around the room here. And I'm going to start with our guest, Greg Davies. Greg, where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Well, you can find me at blendover.com, which is where I post the podcast that I mainly focus on. Twice a week, we do it live as well. If you're interested, Monday nights and Friday nights, 8:30 p.m. Central Time in the United States, and we post the show at blendover.com, iTunes, and Stitcher thereafter. I also want to make mention that my co-host Tare is going to be taking a little bit of leave during the month of January 2014. So if any of the Drill Down listeners or previous guests or co-hosts or anyone is interested in coming in for a guest co-host spot, during January, reach out and get in touch with me. Pretty easy to find online. CGT2099 is the username, and the email is blendoverpodcast@gmail.com.
All right, cool. You can probably sign me up, pencil me in for at least a couple of those.
Absolutely.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not on the show?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. You can see everything I'm doing on flavors.me/DwayneD. That's DwayneD. And maybe you'll see me on Blendover if Greg will have me.
There.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be awesome. Man, I'd tune in for that. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Twitter and Facebook at MrBabyMan. Just look up MrBabyMan on Google and you'll find all my social media stuff there. That's my social media handle. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of these stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Now, a little bit of programming note here. We are taking the rest of the year off. We're not going to record. We usually record on Wednesday. We're not going to record on Christmas or New Year's Day. So we will pick it up again in the following year, 2014. However, having said that, Dwayne and I may do an occasional what we're calling drill bits. And these are just basically short little brief little tech commentaries you may hear from us from time and again.
When are we gonna hear a Drill Down After Dark? That's what I want to see.
There's a thought.
Everything about the Drill Down is after dark.
Essentially. I think our first regular show back of the Drill Down will be January 8th is when we record it, which will be online January 10th. The Friday following after that. So look for that then. But in the meantime, if Dwayne and I do record, and Tosin, of course, is invited as well, if we decide that we're going to do just a brief little short tech commentary and label it Drill Bits, you'll find it in the same feed as the Drill Down. So until then, be sure to catch us in 2014. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Diligo.
Thanks, guys.
A long December, and there's reason to believe maybe this year will be better than the last. I can't remember the last thing that you said as you were leaving. But the days go by so fast. And it's one more day up in the canyon. And it's one more night in Hollywood. If you think that I could be forgiven, I wish you would.